Today is September the 26th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available from wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet, each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. And we are preempted next week on WBAI-FM New York, but the program will return on WBAI on the air the following week. It was reported Google is quietly logging users into Chrome. This was released in early September. Chrome 69 logs the user in automatically at the moment they sign into any Google service. This led to a backlash from privacy-concerned members of the community. The first impression some users had was that the browser would start sending their data back to the Google servers. This was not the case, or at least that's what Google says. Google says it wanted to avoid situations where you could log into its services on a shared device while the browser is logged into someone else's account. This could lead to cookies and other browsing data being synchronized under an account you have nothing to do with. Attackers are using freelance job sites such as 5RR and Freelancer to distribute malware disguised as job offers. These job offers contain attachments that pretend to be the job brief, but actually they install keyloggers such as Agent Tesla or Remote Access Trojan. For those who may be looking for jobs, avoid those two job sites and actually any other job site for what information you download. Firefox installs add-ons into your browser without consent. There were two add-ons not listed anywhere else. That's fxmonitor@mozilla.org and telemetrycoverage@mozilla.org. This suggests that these add-ons has to do with something with telemetry that Firefox stated that all telemetry was turned off. Well, Mozilla wanted to collect data on how many users have opted out of telemetry, so it decided silently to install tracking into everyone's browsers to know who's opting out. It looks like that's exactly what's happening. This time, the telemetry extension made clear effort to hide its activity by only showing up on a debug page and never asking anything else from the user. Well, looks like it's time to use another browser. Private browsing, or privacy mode or incognito mode, is a privacy feature in some web browsers to disable browsing history and the web cache. This allows a person to browse the web without storing any local data that could be retrieved at a later date. Well, a new study from a Vanderbilt professor commissioned by the trade group Digital Content Next found when users switch to an incognito browsing session online, Google can retroactively link back to the users thanks to how deep its digital tentacles reach into the rest of that same user's online experience. If you read the fine print on incognito mode, it brings up a whole lot of disclaimers. A person fires up a private browser session in Chrome on websites that run ads from Google Online Marketplace. Anonymized cookies are dropped on the browsers associated with the user. If the same person leaves private browsing mode and logs into Google services like Gmail or YouTube, the act of signing into Google makes it possible to connect the earlier web activity to the now identified user. The study notes, Google collected or inferred over two-thirds of the information through passive means. Both Android and Chrome send data to Google even in the absence of any user interaction. We have it backwards with cell phones. in which function follows form. It should be form follows function. It's a principle associated with architectural and industrial design, which says that the shape of a building or an object should primarily relate to its intended functions or purpose. Let's get back to basics of a digital cell phone. What an absolute minimum in component parts. You find that it contains just a few individual parts. A circuit board containing the brains of a phone, an antenna to receive the signal and send the signal, a liquid crystal display, an LCD, a keyboard, which is a virtual keyboard, a microphone, a speaker, and, of course, a battery. Remember when phone batteries used to last past bedtime? Without dozens of apps running in the background, your new cell phone should maintain its battery life longer than the typical smartphone. Some of these phones can last on a single charge for days or even go for a whole week without being plugged in. Back in the 1990s, my first cell phone required battery recharge once a week. We now have made progress. I need to recharge the battery each night. The cell phone has evolved into a modern-day Swiss knife smartphone of today. In reality, we have now a personal computer with a built-in camera, GPS, FM radio, and a host of other features with telephony operation in which all the hardware is stuffed into the original basic cell phone design. Something has to give. It is the proverbial stuffing 10 pounds of sugar into a 5-pound bag. When you're in the market for a new smartphone, what features do you typically look for? Perhaps you need to know what processor is installed, or the quality of its camera. The battery's quality is another key decision maker when picking out a new phone. The one-time user removable battery in a cell phone has morphed into a non-removable battery. The de facto battery design today is the non-removable battery. There are two versions of the non-removable battery. On one end of the spectrum is Motorola, in which the user can remove and replace the battery, but it is not a snap-on process. You need to do some disassembly of the unit to change the battery. On the other end of the spectrum, we have Apple. The Apple battery is designed to retain up to 80% of its original capacity at 500 complete charge cycles. Since the iPhone unit is charged each day, the wear factor on the battery becomes a factor in less than 2 years. The one-year warranty includes service charges for a defective battery. If it is out of warranty, Apple offers a battery service for $79 plus about $7 shipping, subject, of course, to local taxes. If the Apple Store or Apple Authorized Service Provider has replacement batteries in stock, the process should be completed within hours, allowing you to walk out with your iPhone on the same day. If the replacement battery is not in stock, how many can do without the use of a cell phone for a few days? It's not something you usually see advertised. Removable batteries can be taken out of the phone, usually by opening up the back plate and taking it out. Non-removable batteries will be encased within the phone's vital components. It'll be hard, if not impossible, to remove the battery without first tampering with very important parts of the phone. Despite its name, non-removable batteries are actually removable. The problem is it often requires so many special tools that it's not practical or feasible to expect the average user to be able to remove one. For instance, it may involve tasks such as undoing the adhesive between the screen and the phone. In short, if you're not an expert, it's very hard to do, and if you have any skepticism about doing it yourself, don't do it. When the battery dies in a non-replaceable unit, the main solution is to bring it to a repair store. This is a nasty surprise for people who believe they can simply remove the battery and get a new one. So why do companies make phones with non-removable batteries? Despite its restrictive nature, there are advantages to them. One advantage of the non-removable battery in the phones is a tighter design. Because a removable battery phone needs to have a backplate, it can compromise the overall design of the phone. Non-removable phones have the battery tucked away in electronics, which means they have little need for a back panel. This allows the manufacturers to create the phone out of high-quality materials and produce a luxury-feeling phone. It also means that non-removable battery phones are slimmer. We now have it backwards. Function follows form. With a non-user replaceable battery, it also helps with recovering a stolen phone. A removable battery can be taken out by a thief and stop the phone from tracking its movement. With the battery safely inside the phone, it makes it harder for a thief to disable security or tracking features. Of course, there's a huge problem with non-removable batteries. They are non-removable. This is, of course, can be a deal breaker for many. Once the battery begins going south, and it will, as the battery is usually the first thing to begin failing, you will also threaten to take the phone with it. This can only be solved with either a great deal of expertise in disassembling phones or by taking it to a repair shop. As such, for the long term, a non-removable battery can bite back in the future. Removable batteries have advantages. Having a battery that can be removed has many benefits. The most obvious one is user replacement after the old one dies. If you like, you can even have a charged spare battery on standby, which you can swap out with your main one if it runs out of a charge at a crucial moment. There's an argument claiming that removing the battery is a good way to shut off a frozen phone. But non-removable battery phones are now adding ways to reboot a stuck phone without needing to touch the battery. A lot of the newer phones only have non-removable battery, with no option for a removable version. While removable batteries are a useful feature, you may find yourself excited for the newest device to be released. Which to get? There's one thing you need to ask yourself. Do you see yourself using the same exact device for, well, more than 2 years? If you want to maximize the lifespan of your phone, a non-removable battery will be a thorn in your side. Pick out a phone that has a replaceable battery and read up on how easy it is to get a spare. That way, you can keep your phone going for as long as possible. While a battery being removable or non-removable isn't a widely advertised feature, it can sometimes make or break a deal on a purchase. Does a non-removable battery bother you, or have you been happily enjoying the phones without a single battery issue?
You know, Hank, it's I think, a variation on Murphy's Law. Murphy said, if anything can go wrong, it would. I like the corollary to Murphy's Law. Murphy was an optimist. A couple of years ago, I needed a new phone, and I wanted something that was a bleeding edge, cutting edge. Everything that it could be was there. It was the best of the finest. And I didn't want it to be the most expensive. It was a pretty expensive phone. I got it from Verizon, and they said that, you know, on a monthly basis, it would take about 2 years to pay it all off. Well, they also suggested I get an insurance policy on it, which I did, and I paid for that as part of the monthly charge, and I didn't pay much attention to it. And then about, give or take, 6 weeks ago, something happened. The phone stopped working, wouldn't take a charge, wouldn't turn on, wouldn't do anything. I took it into Verizon, of course, because I'd been paying for insurance all the way through, and they said, oh, you didn't read the email we sent you. I said, what are you talking about? They said, well, we sent you an email that said the insurance we're selling you is totally worthless, and if you want to pay twice or three times as much, we'll give you a decent policy, but you didn't respond, so you have a completely worthless insurance policy. I said, that doesn't make any sense. Must get me something. I said, oh, yes, if you don't know how to send email or you lose your password, you can call us up and we'll work you through it. Yes, you heard me. Verizon ripped me off. But they also, at the same time, had the very best network for the places I had to be and the places I had to call and my wife and her business. We were pretty well stuck with Verizon for the time being. I had to get a new phone. There was no question. My Pixel was just a very fancy paperweight on my desk. Well, I don't want a lot in a phone. I want a state-of-the-art camera. I want a phone that can take both Wi-Fi and CDMA, or the equivalent of a mobile network, LTE. I want a phone that's small enough to fit in my pocket, where if the battery goes dead, I can just pop open the back and slip in a new battery. Batteries are very small and don't cost much. And where I can buy a phone with the amount of RAM I think I need, but a phone that has a slot in it, an SD slot, so that I can add RAM, 16, 32, 64, whatever I want to add, whenever I want to add it. And then I can, for example, if I'm taking some videos, I can store them on the card and then slip in a different card, take that one, put it in my wallet, and slip in a different card and continue taking videos. These are, you know, not really big deals. So I went over into the phone part of Verizon, and I didn't find any phones, not one, that matched these specs. So I walked over 2-3 blocks away. There was a T-Mobile store. And guess what? They had one phone that matched the specs as far as battery and SD card goes, but it had a lousy camera. It was not state of the art, and it was really a piece of junk. Okay, no big deal. I had a solution. Hank, how would you like to get a smartphone that has all the bells and whistles, that has the high-quality camera, that has a slot in it for SD, that where the back pops off and you can put in a $10 battery? Sound good to you? Well, I knew just where to get one. I went home. I opened up my desk, lower left-hand drawer, pulled out a lot of wires and cables and doohickeys and ink cartridges, and there at the bottom was a cell phone manufactured by Samsung. And it worked perfectly well, doing all the things that I wanted. There was just one catch. It needed a new battery, because the battery that was in it was almost 10 years old. So I put in a new battery. I took it down to my handy-dandy Verizon store. They activated it for me. They even went to the trouble of helping me to put on it all the backup that was in the cloud. And there I go with a new phone. A new phone that has the ability to have an SD card in the slot. As a matter of fact, I just put a 32 gig in a few minutes ago. That has a changeable battery. I only have one because the batteries that I had were all dead. One of them was just about ready to explode. Tomorrow, Amazon is going to deliver me two more batteries. I cost $20, $10 for each one, including shipping and tax. And I'm going to have a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art telephone. Well, it's a Note 4, so that's about pretty close to 10 years old, Hank. And it's better than any of the new ones you're seeing. I know your son gave me the advice to get the new Pixel. State of the art, except no replaceable battery, no SD slot. And you told me about a Motorola that was really great, except, again, no slot, no battery replacement. The thing is that phone manufacturers are not looking to sell phones that can be used by the people who are buying them. They're selling phones that have the latest, the greatest, the best in the neighborhood. You can take it out on the golf course and say to your friends, "Wow, look at this. This is even better than your phone. You bought your phone last year. This is my phone from this year." Except, you know what? I'd rather have the Samsung Note 4. Not the Note 3 and not the Note 5. Certainly not the Note 9, because I have in this phone everything I want. I want to take notes with the Note. I've got a stylus that's hanging out in the bottom of it. It's got a slot for the stylus. I can handwrite notes. I can use the virtual typewriter. That's what most people don't call it. I do. The virtual keyboard is really the term. I can dictate to it. I can pay a few dollars and have that dictation turned into
typed or typeset words. The photos are really good. It comes with free storage in the cloud. That's a Samsung Plus. And it also comes with Verizon storage in the cloud. That's a Verizon Plus. And you know, I don't have to pay anything every month. This is lowering my Verizon bill between the non-insurance that they sell and the prorated monthly charge for the new fancy phone that doesn't work for me. I'm saving about $30 or $40 a month, and I'm pretty happy. Oh, one other thing. When I got this phone a few years ago, I sprang for a leather case for it that would protect it in case I dropped it and would fit in my pocket. And by God, there's a couple of slots inside, just like a wallet, and there's a way to place money and credit cards. And gee, I don't know why I wanted a new phone in the first place. This one's a lot better. Hank, you might want to think about, before you buy a new phone, I know you're now a T-Mobile customer, before you buy a new phone, why don't you check what you have in the bottom left-hand side of your desk?
Before we get to Dr. Alfred's poor segment, I just wanted to tell you first that he will be the feature speaker at the Brookdale Computer User Group tomorrow. Topic of presentation is Healthy Worker, Happy Company, and the Growing Role of Employee Health Monitoring. Healthy workers should translate into better outcomes for the employers. Reduce time lost to sickness, improve productivity, lower health care and insurance costs, they all contribute directly to the bottom line. But are these employee wellness programs working? And are there any negative effects? Meeting is Thursday tomorrow. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. The Middletown Library Computer Lab at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. In a change of pace, Dr. Alfred Poor from Health Tech Insider shares insights he gained from attending the North American Healthcare Forum in Dublin, Ireland last week. Hear about new innovations and their implications for wearable and mobile health devices, telehealth services, and healthcare in general.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
If you're keeping score, you may have noticed that I did not provide a Health Tech Insider segment last week. The reason was that I was traveling. I was in Dublin, Ireland for a conference. This week, instead of my usual segment content, I decided that I'd provide a short conference report instead. There was a lot of interesting content at the conference, much of which has a direct bearing on the health and medical markets that I normally cover here. The event was called the North America Healthcare Forum, and it was hosted by Enterprise Ireland. Enterprise Ireland is a government agency tasked with helping support innovative companies in Ireland and help them export their products and services to other countries. And here's a little background that I learned along the way. Now, Ireland is not a large country. It has a total population of about 5 million people, which makes it a little bit smaller than the Philadelphia metro area. All the same, it still racks up about $15 billion a year in medical technology exports alone. Their exports are a lot bigger when you include things like Guinness, whiskey, and wool. Still, 15 out of the 20 largest medical technology companies in the world have bases in Ireland. Now, you may have encountered Irish medical technology without even knowing it. 25% of all diabetes injection devices worldwide are made in Ireland, and about a third of all contact lenses come from Ireland. Well, the conference was an opportunity for representatives from Irish health tech companies to meet with representatives from major health care companies and hospitals in the U.S. and Canada. Among the many fascinating speakers was Michael Dowling. He was born in Ireland and is currently the president and CEO of Northwell Health. This is the largest healthcare provider in New York State. It serves more than 7 million residents through a network of 21 hospitals and a lot of other facilities. My favorite quote from Dowling's speech was the following. He said, "Feed the positive message about healthcare." Now, I am admittedly a Pollyanna cheerleader for innovation in healthcare and technology. But I'm also the first to admit that the media covers a lot of negative stories about medicine and healthcare. We hear about tainted medications, about how much doctors hate electronic health record systems, and about how little time healthcare professionals get to spend with patients, and the skyrocketing costs of healthcare insurance and treatments. As a result, it's easy to lose sight of how far medicine has come in just the last 10 to 20 years. Open-heart surgery is rare. Most procedures are now minimally invasive and rely on tiny incisions. Stents have saved countless heart attack patients. Hepatitis C used to be a lifelong chronic disease. Now it could be eradicated. And diabetes patients now have the option of a combined constant glucose monitor and an insulin injector, a pump, that can reduce or eliminate the need for frequent finger sticks and manual injections. Today, even smartphone apps are now being approved as medical devices, and these programs are prescribed as treatment for a variety of conditions. We cover wearable and mobile devices for health and medical applications at Health Tech Insider, and so we get to tell the stories about many new products and services and technologies that deliver better outcomes to patients, save lives, and help lower health costs at the same time. I'd like to think that we followed Dowling's instructions to feed the positive message, as there are many positive stories to be told in this industry. Dowling also made another statement that I thought was worth noting. He said, "Nostalgia is not a strategy." We tend to think of the good old days without remembering all the bad aspects that were also part of those days. Not only can we not go back, we shouldn't go back. If there are elements that we miss from those days, such as time spent with the insightful family doctor, we need to look ahead and find ways to build that into modern system in ways that make medical and fiscal sense and that improve the quality of care. And while I'm on the subject of quotes, a speaker from the Irish government quoted Abraham Lincoln in her remarks. It's a bit of a mouthful, so I'm going to say it twice. Here it goes. "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present." Let me repeat that. "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present." The health and medical worlds are certainly stormy these days, and it makes good sense that the solutions that used to work well enough, or that at least we were willing to accept, won't get the job done today. I was also particularly struck by this quote because it seems to fit many of the other social storms that we are dealing with in our country and worldwide these days. Ah, but enough philosophy. How about some concrete information on a very clever health tech program? Going back to Michael Dowling, he singled out three areas that are poised for big growth in the healthcare industry: home care, remote patient monitoring, and biomedical devices. I got to spend some time talking with a representative from a company called Solasso that has created a physical therapy platform that supports what they describe as evidence-based exercise prescription. They rely on smartphones and other devices to monitor a patient's activity. Each patient gets a personalized exercise program based on their specific needs, and the platform helps guide them through those exercises. Now, this platform can be applied to a wide range of conditions and illnesses. Different treatment programs rely on different components. Some use connected devices such as a smart weight scale or a blood pressure cuff so that they can monitor the key values for the patient. They even have a program for COPD patients that tracks their pulse oxygen levels and their heart rate. It's a flexible system. It can be customized for everything from employee fitness incentive programs to tracking patients after they've been discharged from the hospital. The biggest takeaway from the conference for me, though, is that healthcare systems are truly becoming information systems. We know more about our bodies, both healthy and sick, and this information is becoming more available both to healthcare professionals and to patients, which helps the patients become better consumers of healthcare services and become more proactive in their healthcare decisions. The result is better outcomes for everyone.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. There's a wealth of administrative tools under the hood of Windows. There are graphical user interface tools, and there are command prompt-based tools. The graphical user interface administrative tools are all over the place in Windows. There's a range of handy customizations and tweaks for your PC, and many of the features and settings are not visible in the settings screen. The navigational path is not necessarily identical between Windows 10 Home Premium and Windows 10 Professional. So when I'm often asked, how does one restore the operating system to a prior point in time? I have to find out what version they're using and basically walk them through it. There's no quick way I can give them a set of instructions. The navigational steps to access the function is not simple, as it varies with the different versions of Windows. If you want to find these treasure gems all under one roof, and it's possible you can do that, what you do is there's God mode. God mode, that's G-O-D-M-O-D-E, is a hidden capability that when activated will provide very easy access to more than 200 tools and settings that are normally scattered behind menus and windows. How many of us can remember how to access over 200 tools? Oh, by the way, you can be an atheist and you're allowed to use God mode. To activate God mode, what you do is do a search on the word Microsoft G-O-D-M-O-D-E, two words, Microsoft G-O-D-M-O-D-E, and what you get is a label to be used. So what you do is you copy into the clipboard the value of that label. On the open desktop, you click on to open a new folder. You rename the folder with the label that you have gotten from the search when you did a search on God mode. God mode is a hidden folder that makes available a range of handy customizations for your PC. The best part is that it's easy to install and it's not complicated at all. God mode is a quick access folder full of shortcuts to administrative tools and settings. It also makes it a breeze to place any of these shortcuts to those settings anywhere else like on your desktop. The hidden tweak, which not many know about, was available for Windows 8, Windows 8.1, and it still works for Windows 10. The God mode feature basically offers easy access to the many features under the Windows operating system, as well as the customization options, all in a single interface. It also sorts them into categories, such as administrative tools and display, to make life a lot easier. If you're looking to change the resolution of a monitor or alter the taskbar notification space, it's all available at a single click, thanks to God mode. As Windows 10 has shifted maximum features to the settings screen and is phasing out the traditional control panel, one will be able to access the settings on your PC that exist in the latest operating system, but not readily visible in the new UI or the settings screen. Once you turn on the God mode feature, however, you will find all these section headings, each with their own set of tasks. If you need to undo God mode, in other words, you just want to get rid of it, you can just delete the folder to get rid of it. However, if you need to remove God mode on a folder that already has data in it, don't delete it. Then we have command prompt-based tools. Under search key in CMD, what you do is you right-click on the CMD and you execute with administrative rights. After the command prompt brings up the DOS-based screen, then if you key in help, a list of some of the commands that are available will appear on the screen. There are many command prompt-based commands available. Command prompt is one of Microsoft Windows' most powerful tools, and for the majority of end users, one of them most underutilized. While its capabilities are as helpful as they are useful, CMD itself is hardly intuitive. At first glance, novice users probably wouldn't get much out of it. Unfortunately, the help command does not have document support for all the commands, and with some of them, without the help support, what you can do is just key in the command followed by space forward slash, and in some cases, you will get some help documentation with it. Just to give you an idea what some of the things that can be done in it, okay? What if you have doubts about the integrity of the operating system? What can you do short of reinstalling the operating system? Well, there's under the command-based utility, there is a system file checker to repair missing or corrupted files. When you load in CMD with administrative rights, the command is SFC space / scan now. Now, this will take a number of minutes to do because we're going through the whole operating system. And it will scan the whole system, and it will identify, and actually it will repair any part of the operating system that is either missing or corrupt. That's a great utility to run every once in a while if you have doubts about the operating system. How many command prompt-based commands are available in Windows 10? I think you'd be surprised. On my Windows 10 Pro 64-bit operating system, there are 626 commands. How do you find out what they are? Well, simply when you first go into command mode, just do a dir space *.exe, and you then have a list of all the commands. Some of them are documented, some of them not documented. I didn't have a chance to go through all of them, but there's a wealth of administrative tools and utilities. The idea of a 40-year maintenance-free home is attractive, but if you're in your 70s and 80s, it may not be worth the investment. The same is true for being energy miserly. It's not simply a balance sheet. Factors like possibly becoming more vulnerable to home repair scams. As you age, there are many factors, and the value of comfort may have as much impact as energy saving. Marty, please explain it.
For about 3 years now, Hank has been asking me how to retrofit an existing house to be more like my energy miserly 40-year maintenance-free cybernetic design. I've been telling him that you really can't, and the truth is, it's extremely difficult to make a lot of this stuff happen once the foundation is laid, the walls are up, and the wires and plumbing have already been run. But let's attack that question more head-on and deal only with the things that it makes the most sense to address. What is the single most critical thing you can do? It comes down to keeping the roof out of the living room. I would nominate a thick layer of high-density foam, like foamsulate, F-O-A-M-S-U-L-A-T-E. That goes on the underside of the attic ceiling. And I strongly urge you to only let a trained pro take on that work. If you can thermally separate the top surface of the attic, which is, after all, the underside of the roof, if you can isolate that from the temperature extremes atop the roof, you'll go a very long way toward mitigating energy losses in that house. Find somebody who knows what they're doing with attic spaces and pay them to have a look at yours and make suggestions. You may want to add or delete ventilation fans, close soffits, or make other changes, but it's up to you with the best advice you can get. Have an HVAC pro inspect any ventilation duct runs up there. If they're rectangular, replace them with round ductwork. You can go the extra mile and get double wall ductwork to help stop energy losses in the ventilation run, but it's also pretty effective to apply purpose-built thermal wraps to those ducts. If you're not changing the ductwork, have them be very thorough in finding gaps in the run and seal those using at least two different methods, like foam plus foil tape. While you're up there, swap LED bulbs for whatever's now in the attic light sockets. Just these measures in the attic accomplish many kinds of good. The air in the attic becomes a buffer, so outdoor temperatures have a much harder time penetrating into the topmost floor of the house, which may be the main level in a ranch or simply the upstairs in many houses. Your costs for heating or cooling those spaces will drop. With less heating or cooling to do, the wear and tear on the HVAC system will also drop, helping you go a longer time before you face those expensive repairs or replacements. You've just made the attic a more conditioned space. Maybe fully conditioned if there are no other issues up there, but at least semi-conditioned. If your roof doesn't leak, this thermal conditioning makes it a safer place to store all that stuff you don't need anymore but haven't yet gotten around to discarding. following the same logical path, that thermal separation leads to energy savings and delays the maintenance needs of HVAC gear, come up with a plan for your windows. It costs an arm and a leg to replace them all at once, so be methodical. Take a notepad and a thermometer around to every window whenever outside temperatures are either so hot or so cold that you wouldn't want to live outdoors. Write down the readings, all of them, every one of them, of the temperature just inside the window. Try to do the same exercise once with the sun in the east and once with the sun in the west. Those numbers will tell you which window is your priority to replace, which comes next, and so on. Oh, do be sure to also note which windows are in rooms in constant use and which are in mostly unused rooms. The overall plan is to identify the one room that has the most critical need for new and better windows. You can get by with only buying for one room at a time, but this is critical. Find an expert, not just a salesperson, not just somebody in an apron at a big box store. There are differences in the window paints, three panes or two, with or without special coatings, with what kind of gas between the panes. Check out the major brands and seek out a pro. Each window presents a different usage case. East and west windows may have similar requirements if your house is in the middle of a flatland, but the chances are there are other factors individual to your house, things like shading, things that influence what that window needs to accomplish. And the same is true for north and south windows. There are almost too many options. How many panes, interior films or coating, the gas between the panes, whether or not there are thermal breaks built into the frames, that kind of thing. Let me add some specific advice. If you start seeing good, better, best graphics, you may be talking to a salesperson and not an energy expert. Find an energy expert. I just used the term thermal breaks when talking about the window frames, and I should explain that. If, on a hot day and with the sun hitting a specific window, you can be inside and touch its frame and that window frame feels hot, you're experiencing thermal conductivity. That window frame becomes a rectangular space heater, either bringing the outdoor heat in or, if it's winter and the frame feels cold, sending your indoor warmth outside. A thermal break inside the window frame stops that. It's created by adding a short insulating layer that keeps the outside of the frame from exchanging thermal energy with the inside of the frame. Learn a lot and be as smart as you can in that first window replacement. When you get another chunk of money in your pocket, you can move ahead with replacing whatever is then the neediest window. But that doesn't mean you need to totally ignore those other windows in the meantime. For the windows that you can't replace, check with a hardware store or Lowe's or Home Depot to see what you can do to temporarily make things better. There are lots of products for that. Those stores are good for the add-ons, but for the window upgrade, you want to consult a more knowledgeable expert in window options and frame options. I also want to adjust your expectations a bit. A window is smaller than an attic, so you'll spend more money on the windows and get not quite the same scope of results, which is why you want to go through that initial exercise of logging what a thermometer says at each and every window. If it's time to do something major with the HVAC, do a lot of homework and look for the word variable. Variable ratio compressors, like scroll compressors, and variable speed blowers are much more energy efficient and much more likely to go a longer time without needing attention. If you live someplace that sees temperatures in the 30s or colder more than 30 to 60 nights a year, look into hydronic heat, essentially hot water from a recirculating tankless water heater. You see, those are the temperatures at which a heat pump can't fully provide enough heat on its own to compensate for the cold. Something has to go into the system to boost the heat. I personally don't like using electric heat for that because those heating elements can start the meter spinning really fast, a relatively high cost per BTU. Gas would be fine if you were allowed to scale it intelligently, but building codes insist on any gas heat being able to support everything on its own. So you end up with these two big arrays that quickly overheat the house, and then after it cools down, it does the same thing again. Your indoor comfort level is on a seesaw. Hydronic heat is, I believe, a better answer. I don't yet have a recommendation on the evaporator and condenser coils. It's as if everything out there is designed to corrode and fail just to keep HVAC service teams active and open up opportunities to sell you new, more expensive units, even if everything but the coils is just fine. If you trust your HVAC guy, and if he works with more than one brand, be inquisitive. I mentioned one of my mnemonic maxims last time, max factor makeup, meaning maximize the scope of factors you use in calculating before you make up your mind about when and whether it's worth buying anything more expensive than the cheapest choice out there. Max factor makeup. The same is true for energy improvements. If natural gas reaches your house, then go for gas as the better choice the next time you have to replace a major appliance. It's not just that natural gas tends to cost less head-to-head, but that gas burners have far fewer failures than electric heating elements, and you have to include failures of the electric heating element control systems in that. I won't tell you to rip out what you have now if it's still working. Just keep it in mind the next time you need to replace something. Another element you can address falls under the umbrella that I've been calling chains of consequence. For example, lime and minerals in tap water are a major cause of needing to replace plumbing fixtures like faucets or showerheads. So whole house water conditioning may be a good idea. That may also save you needing to have filtered water pitchers or filters at the sink or filters in the fridge. When you think about water, think about the water you use for drinking or food preparation, separately from the water you use for washing or bathing or flushing or laundry, and think about that separately from the water you use for watering the lawn or washing the car. Have your water independently tested and have a pro, not just a salesperson, interpret that for you. While that test is happening, check out the costs of faucets and showerheads. All of that will lead you to an informed decision. Oh, if it's a whole house water conditioning system, don't settle for half the data. Get all of the actual costs, every penny. Find out if there's some subtly presented bundle that compels you to pay extra fees every year for things like service plans. Find out what elements of the system will need replacement, how often, and at what cost. And get in touch with people who have been using that specific system for at least 5 years. You don't have that luxury with computers, but you do with water conditioners. Speaking of water, each and every time any length of pipe needs replacing, try replacing it with PEX pipe, P-E-X, PEX pipe, and not just for where the problem occurred. PEX pipe endures more and lasts longer. It's especially effective when you use it in conjunction with a manifold block, which is kind of like a circuit breaker box, but for water. Make a point of looking up PEX, P-E-X, and reading up on it, and also look up home run as a way to configure plumbing. And the next time you talk to your plumber, ask about it. You don't have to yank all of those old pipes out of the house all at once to retrofit with PEX piping. You can if you want to. But doing it incrementally as the old plumbing fails may be easier for your budget to swallow. Just remember that a meaningful chunk of the money you'll pay a plumber for any scope of work is already spent the minute he or she knocks at your door. One huge advantage of installing PEX on home runs is that it eliminates plumbing junctions, and junctions are the most likely point of a plumbing failure. Also, remember that any major water leak can cost you more than a complete PEX retrofit if it gets out of hand. Yeah, more factors to consider. And on that topic, that new house. How old are you? You're planning to live there another what? 20 or 30 years? How old will you be then? Maintenance and repair scams that defraud a disproportionate number of older people, obviously because they target the elderly, may, when you're old enough, target you. And as sharp-minded as you are right now, which I know because you listen to the show and you even endure my segments, you can't count on your mind not starting to turn a little, shall we say, slippery as you get on in years. Visit your local police department, sit down for a chat about how those scams work, and ask their advice. Then talk to your kids and your attorney about things you can set up to avoid being taken in. I won't get into those things here, and anyway, every circumstance is a little different. But there's another point to this. If you intend to still be in this house and age in place, that swings the scale slightly in favor of getting more preventive and corrective measures done to the house earlier rather than later. Now, Hank may be sharp as a whip. When I get a little older, I may turn out to only be as sharp as a licorice whip. Time will tell. Even here and now, I start talking about retrofitting a house to reduce your costs, the cost of energy, the cost of repairs, and so on. But saving money can't just be about the money. You have to consider your comfort and your safety and your reality. Your life, your pursuit of happiness, your freedom from oppression, these are things you can't simply back up. So, absent a reasonable way to restore them, the wisest choice would seem to be to protect them.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation by Dr. Alfred Poor, my colleague. Topic is Healthy Worker, Happy Company, The Growing Role of Employee Health Monitoring. Meeting is on Thursday, September the 27th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Computer Lab in Middletown Township Public Library, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing, New Jersey. They have a presentation on the really smart way to buy a printer. They meet on Tuesday, October 2nd at 1:30 p.m. and they meet at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a meeting on Tuesday, October the 2nd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on Premier Elements 2018. They meet on Thursday, October the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, October the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU at 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, October the 12th at 7 p.m., and they'll meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall, New York Institute of Technology, located at Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, October the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the community room at the Princeton Public Library at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access session at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb computer question. And we hope to see you at these meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM New York, 99.5 on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again next week on PRN.FM, and we are preempted next week on WBAI-FM New York, but the program will return on WBAI on the air the following week.